So this evening, I like to continue a little from the instruction this morning. And so I'd like to look again at the two elements of concentration and experiential inquiry, and to look how they work. And then I'll go a little more with the insight element. So we are cultivating together. So samatha and vipassana, concentration, focusing, anchoring, and vipassana, experiential inquiry. And then the question is a little, how do they work? Because actually, why the meditation work is because by cultivating these two elements, there are some effects. And so the way to look at it is, for example, if we take the concentration, the anchoring, to see that each time we come back to the anchoring object, that it be the breath, the body, the sound, or whatever, actually four things is happening. And that's why I think it's very important to see that it's not that you're trying to hold onto the breath or onto the body, but in the coming back again and again, that's where actually something happened. So, the first thing that happened, if I take, let's, as an example, I will take mental habits. Sometime when we meditate over time, we notice that we have similar types of thoughts. And so, and then we start to think the thought and we cannot stop it. So, we are sitting in meditation, we try to be aware of the breath or the body, and then a thought arises, and generally, we continue with it. Generally, we identify with it, we have lots of story attached to it, and then it kind of becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And so, when we're doing the meditation, the anchoring part is, at some point we see, oh, I am distracted or whatever it is, and then you come back. And so at that point, the first thing you're doing is you're not feeding the habit. So in a way, the habit is not going to be more consolidated, is not going to become greater and greater. So that's the first thing that happened. You are not feeding the habit, which is generally what we do. We just go on and on and on. So generally we amplify. What we, in a technical term, we say proliferate. How can you say that in Finnish? Proliferate. Anybody? I mean, in the technical term, in Buddhism is prapancha. How can you translate that? Anybody?
I have no idea.
Okay, so let's go for, it's like... That's it. People understand this word? That's it. You got it. Thank you. So here, you're not feeding that because you're not continuing with it. So you're not making it more and more. First thing. Secondly, by not feeding it and by coming back, you're dissolving the power of the habits. And then if you do that, you help to bring the habit back to creative functioning. So we can see that the meditation is not about stopping the thought. But the meditation is to help us to bring the thoughts back to their creative functioning. And then the last thing that happened is that we come back to the breath and the body, but also at the same time, we come back to everything else. So we come back to the whole moment. When we lost in a thought, we are in a bit of abstraction. We are in a bit of our experience. not the whole thing, us sitting here in this moment, in this place, in this time. Because you could be physically sitting here. You see, I could be sitting here my first time in Finland, and actually I could spend all my time thinking about being in New York. And so I really would not be here, or think about being in the Bahamas, or whatever. So this is a fourth thing that happened, which I think is really important and very useful. But maybe I need to explain a little what I mean by creative functioning. Does everybody understand the term? Okay. So, let's say that we sit in meditation, and suddenly, you know, with the breath, with the body, and suddenly we have what I would call a trigger thought, what I call trigger word. If I had, if I was. And then this comes up, and then generally you go into what is called in English daydreaming. Do you have the same word in Finnish? So you just make a dream. And it's like you make a film. When I was in Korea, sitting in meditation, and there I did a lot of meditation, and one day I realized that my trigger thought was, if I went to a hermitage in the mountain, if I sat in meditation really, really hard, then I would awaken, then I would save everybody. And then I realized, I am dreaming about meditating, I am not meditating. This is not the same thing. And so, once I saw that, then over time, I mean, the habit diminished. But the creative functioning of daydreaming is imagining. So imagining is very useful. But daydreaming is actually can be frustrating. Because, you know, you might be at home and you dream, I don't know, about the perfect husband and the perfect children, or the perfect wife and the perfect children. And the wife or the husband come back really cranky, and the children come back really problematic. And you think, why are not they like in the dream? They're not like in the dream because this is a multiple reality. In the dream, everything, that's why it's so pleasant to do daydreaming when you sit in meditation, also in daily life. Because in it, everything goes according to plan. It's like if you were making a film, and in it you do everything. You are the actor or actress, you are the director, you are the producer, you even sell the peanuts. And so it's wonderful. Everything goes as you want. And then you tinker, you improve it. That's why when I ring the bell, you feel, oh, already, this was such a good one. But we have to see, if we're too lost in this habit, it can become very frustrating. But it comes from creative functioning. The same with planning. Sometimes this is also something we do when we sit in meditation. We plan how much we're going to eat, we plan where we're going to walk, we plan should I sit longer or not today, or we plan our holiday, or we plan our retirement, or whatever it is. And then we do it once, twice, 10 times, we go psh, psh. And so when it's a habit, it's like we take an over. It's like we think, the more I think about it, the better it's going to get. When actually I would say, the less you think about it, the better it's going to get. Planning is useful. But incessant planning is very tiring, very stressful. I used to do a lot of it until I realized it was bad for my stomach. And then I stopped. It was not worth it. So I do it a bit, and then I stop. And then maybe later, I look at it a bit, then I stop. And I found that I become much more creative. And so the planning again is useful, but not as a repetitive activity. Or something else you might do when you are sitting in meditation. I call it ruminating, but I don't know if you have a Finnish word for that. Thank you. So generally it starts, you find here, and suddenly, as I mentioned previously, you think suddenly something bad from the past appear. He said this, she said that, this happened, this is terrible, how could they? And then you bypass the present, and you go into the future, and you plot revenge. Very compassionate activity. They're going to say that, I'm going to say that, and I'll get them. But if you look at it, you cannot change the past. The past is gone. We can learn from the past, but we cannot change it. And the past is in the past. There is little point apart from suffering to bring it now. And in the future, generally they don't say what you plan for them to say. And the only thing we can do is practice now. So that we cultivate stability and openness, so then when we meet them, we can creatively respond. I mean, there are many different habits, but the last one I want to mention is judging. And judging is a tricky one. Its creative function is discrimination. Judging is a root of wisdom. This is an important function to have. This is a bell. This is a glass. I mean, I could still use a glass as a bell. I mean, it could work. But this is a clock. I mean, I don't think it'd be a good idea to use it as a bell. And I'm not sure I could read the time in the bell or in the glass. So, judging discrimination is just saying, oh, this is a clock, this is a glass, this is a bell. So this is very useful, very important. But then when it becomes habituated, it's actually a very weighty, very heavy way of having a mental habit. Because it's kind of like you have a little judge on your shoulder, kind of, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. It's kind of a little above and kind of judging. But then this is a tricky one. Because if you do meditation, then you start to have the judging of the judging of the judges. You know, I should be mindful, I should not be judging. And then you cannot. And with judging, we need to be like with a difficult friend. We're a little careful. You know, okay? So just being very gentle. Oh, judging. Okay. I can come back to the breath. So in a way, the practice is very good because it makes us, it's information. We can see all these different habits floating about. And we can also know that through the practice, we can help them go back to their creative functioning. That's a very important part of the concentration. And of course, if we come back, the last one, which is to come back to the whole moment, this is very vital to have a creative response. In abstraction, you can have a lot of things, but this is not dealing with the condition now. It's dealing with abstracted conditions. And so when we come back to the moment, we can see, yes, there is this problem, there is this difficulty, there is that, but my whole life is not just that. This is just one part of other conditions in my life. And so that we can have a multi-perspective. We can have a perspective which is much wider about ourselves, about our situation, about other people. And so when we cultivate that concentration, that anchoring, that focusing, then these four things happen. And that's why over time, we become more calm, more quiet, and also we become more spacious. So you can have thoughts, you can have feelings, you can have sensations, but there, around them there is space. It's not sticky, it's not heavy. And because of that space, there can be more creativity. Then the other aspect is vipassana, looking deeply, experiential inquiry. And as I mentioned, it's very much about change and about being aware of conditionality. But on retreat, I think it's more useful to be aware of change. And in daily life, we can be more aware of conditionality in a practical way. Because on a retreat where not so much happened, then the conditionality, I think, is a little, can become a little abstract, a little intellectual. And I think it's better to keep it more experiential if we can. So the first thing, change. And so, to me, this is something we can really use in daily life. Is how long is this going to last? And this is something you can do for all kinds of different things. A thought, a feeling, a sensation. And through that, you can know, is this something I really have to address or not? Instead of putting everything to the same degree. Something are important, something are less important. Something matters, something does not matter. Once I was in the car with my husband, and we had problem parking, and so we had a little, it was a little heavy. And then he said something which was a little unpleasant. And so I felt, oh, he said something unpleasant. And then, of course, I could have answered something unpleasant too. But I thought instead, let's see how long this unpleasant feeling lasts. And so I just sat there in the car while he was driving, and I just observed the feeling. And it lasted 2 red lights. And then he was gone. Then another time, I went to a garden center to buy plants. And there I did not understand the lady, and she was in a hurry, and she looked at me like I was really stupid. You know, I really was stupid not to get it. So finally I got it, and you know, I did what I had to do, but I felt, oh! You know, like when the person is not very pleasant, and you feel, oh! And generally you think, I will never go back to that place. But instead of thinking that, I thought, how long is this going to last? So, it lasted 2 hours. The feeling itself lasted 2 hours. Then it stopped. But then whenever I thought about it, for 1 hour, the feeling came back. And then, after that, when I thought about it, the feeling did not come back. And I went back to the shop. And it's fine. So there, it's not important. Because the thing comes, and it's gone. But then sometime, you have a different feeling. And you think, But then you say to yourself, being a good Buddhist, a good meditator, no. I understand the poor thing. No. All right. Then it happens again. And you think, no. I must be kind and loving. May you be happy. May you be at peace. You know, it's okay. And then the third time you shout at the person. And they don't know why. They think, but you did not say anything the first two times. And that's why there we have to be careful. To see, this is still there. You see, I think, sometimes when you anger become resentment, I don't think it's better. So it's kind of in a way, when you see something lasting, oh, there is a situation. I have to address it. How can I address it? This is a question. How can I talk about this so that the person can listen? I mean, if you attack the person, you always do this. Then they'll say, well, I might do this, but you do that. And then we go into, what I call buying and selling, each to his own. But how can you express it in a way which works, that the person can listen to and you can kind of understand each other? And I think this is, again, something we can cultivate a lot in our daily life. But also, this practice of really being aware of change, it's about, in a way, de-fixing. Because we have such a tendency to say, it's always like this. Or to say to somebody, you are always like this. You will never change. I mean, this, I think, is one of the most unkind and not compassionate things to say to somebody. You will never change. Or to say to yourself, I will never change. Because what are you saying when you're saying that? Every second, every hour, every day, every week, every month, every year, 24 hours, you're going to do that. But you can't. Because of impermanence. When I learned to drive, I was a little nervous. And then time to time, in those days you could still do that, I locked the key inside the car. So then I would call my husband, can you come with the spare set? Then he would arrive. And so the third time on the phone he said, you always lock the key in the car. And I thought, oh, divorce is near here. I had, like a vision forever after, Then I realized it's not true. I am not always doing it. I do it time to time. Then I said, but when do I do it? Then I looked at the trigger, the contributing factor, the condition. And the main thing was parking in a tight place. So then when I had to park in a tight place, I went for the key. And then it never happened again. So this is the thing. We might have certain tendency. We might have certain habits. But they are not always activated. It changes. It's according to conditions. So this is the thing about change. Change and conditionality go together. And so, if we move from, it's always like this, then we get stuck. There is not much you can do with, it's always like this. But if you move then to, what are the conditions in which this happens? And then you can creatively engage with it. And so that's why I think it's so important to be aware of change. And then through that, to be aware of condition. And I would even say that to be aware of change is actually the root of compassion. And so to see that this looking deeply, this experiential inquiry is not only helping us to be clear and bright, but I would say it's also helping us to transform through compassion. That actually seeing and knowing how things arise is what also leads to a compassionate attitude. Let me explain it. Let's take change. So change, you have two type of change. First, the first one is, you could say, ultimate change. And ultimate change basically is death. But we don't live often as if we might die soon, as we might die tomorrow. We generally think, well, a few years, I mean, nowadays we told, you know, women, I just read Wikipedia on Finland, you know, and it looks like the women, they have up to 82, and the men just a little less. So you feel, well, I'm from Finland, I should live up to at least 70, 82 possibly. And so you feel, well, you know, lots of time. But you never know. But I think to me it makes a big difference. Because when I, many years ago, I saw my father die. I saw his last breath. And it totally changed. In that moment, I really understood impermanence. I really understood change. Because up to then, I looked at impermanence more like fatalism. Oh, the vase is broken. Who cares? It's impermanent and it's not mine. I don't care. But in that moment, I understood what my teacher in Korea often said, your life rests upon a single breath. What are you going to do with this life then? And by seeing that last breath of my father and the death after that, I started to see people in such a different way. I started to see that, oh yes, each person, their life rests upon a single breath. And looking at my mother, I saw her as a human being first, with that single breath. Instead of all the story we had together. And it totally changed our relationship. And so it made me see people as precious, as not taking them for granted, not taking my life for granted. And then there is that, what I would call that, compassion for what is fragile. And so that to appreciate it while it's there. Then the second aspect of change, of impermanence, is a fact, and that I think is a gift of impermanence, the fact that there is a potential for change. People might not change now, but at some point, there could be a potential for change. And to me, that actually is a compassionate move. Instead of thinking, I am stuck, they're stuck, I can't do anything, they can't do anything, and then things don't move. Here he's saying, oh, the person might be stuck now, I might be stuck now, but it doesn't mean at some point I might not change. And to me it's kind of like having that deep faith about that. Which then leads to this compassionate attitude toward others. And two things there. Having the patience for ourselves to change, other to change. But also having that creative movement of, I would say, planting seeds. To me, that's the way I see it. I plant seed in myself for others. And at some point, it will blossom. Something will happen. But I have no expectation in terms of time. But I do believe there can be transformation at some point. And I've seen this again and again. But sometimes it doesn't work like you think it should work. I mean, the same time when my nephew was at my mother and with his difficulty, I was a nun, like, what could I do? I said, well, I'll teach him about breath meditation. He was not really interested, but he had nothing else to do. So he listened to me a little bit, and he said, oh, okay. And what was interesting is, like, 15 years later, he came to me and said, oh, you know that one time you taught me the breath meditation? Whenever I'm stressed, I use it, you know, and it's very useful. And again, I have that experience of planting seed, and then later, it has some effect. And sometimes I even plant seed, and I'm not aware I'm doing it. Last time I went to Korea, I met this young monk, and he said, because of you, I became a monk. I said, ah? He said, yes, you talked about this, and it totally changed my life. I could not remember it whatsoever. So you even can make change without knowing it at all. So I think to me this is really part of being aware of change, is that that compassionate move of knowing at some point this can change. Then there is another thing the Buddha sometimes tell us to look at. And this is called dukkha. And dukkha can be translated in three different ways. Unreliability, unpredictable, unsatisfactory, and what is called also dukkha-dukkha, which then really means suffering, pain. And so the first two, of course, unreliability, just that things are not reliable because they're impermanent. So it's kind of a little obvious. Then the next one, the Buddha is not saying you cannot get no satisfaction, but he's saying you cannot get permanent satisfaction, that nothing is going to give you permanent satisfaction. That it be a job, that it be a meditation, that it be whatever, that too will be impermanent. So he's not saying don't enjoy yourself, he's just saying enjoy yourself while you can. This is not going to last. But the third one is interesting, the dukkha-dukkha. Because the Buddha is saying, he's kind of like, be really aware of pain, of suffering. He's not saying you must have more suffering than you have. No. He's saying, be aware of it. Know it. See and know it. And the reason for that, I feel, is partly because it helps us to be more compassionate. And I would say for two reasons. Because when we are in pain, we realize two things. First, it's painful. But secondly, nobody else can experience our pain for us. Which means that we are isolated in our pain. And so, sometimes, I know when I was young, I used to be a little, you know, I was very healthy and I had no trouble. So if somebody was ill, I used to have that idea, it's all in your mind. Get your mind together and you won't have pain, which was really uncompassionate looking back on it. Until I was ill, I was really ill with my stomach when I was in Korea. And the first thought I had was, why me? And I thought, what? Wait a minute. When you think, why me? You're basically saying, why not somebody else? And this is not very compassionate. So I thought, all right. Then I thought, poor me, I'm suffering. This is terrible. Then I thought, but this is what the Buddha talks so much about. And then it made me so much more compassionate. When I'm in pain, but also when others are in pain, I feel compassion for their pain. And so, of course, I try to help them if I can, knowing that they are isolated in their pain. And I think that's why it's so important to be aware of suffering, to be aware of the condition of it. And in a way, through that, to have compassion for it. And the last one, the Buddha looked at, and I refer to it as conditionality. And a lot of the time, it's more referred to as anatta. And so anatta, this famous Buddhist word, generally is translated as no self. My husband, who knows about these things, said no, it's not self. So I don't know if it makes a big difference in Finnish, but in English it does for some people. And personally, I rather look at it as conditionality. Because if you talk about not self, it's negating something. Instead of, I think what the Buddha is trying to make us see that is that we are a flow of conditions. Each of us is a flow of inner conditions meeting outer conditions. And I feel the part of the practice is to discover all these conditions. And when we look at the conditions, then I think to me one of the very obvious things is to look at ourselves. How do we survive? How do I continue to live day by day? And generally we have this idea that, you know, I am the one which makes me survive. I am a survival machine. But if you look at it, actually not. Bare survival, the air I breathe, the water I drink, the food I eat, the clothes I wear, the house I live in, the medicine I take, all this, generally, unless I am a hardcore self-reliant person, all this I don't make. This is made, is outside. This comes from the outside. So basically my survival, your survival, depends on all these different outside conditions. People tilling the field, people collecting the cotton, people making the drugs, etc., etc. So my existence depends on other existence. And again, out of that, we realize we are not isolated. We are totally connected with the world. And through that, in a way, having compassion, having love for these other on which my existence depends. And I think one easy thing to, one easy practice with that is connected to the breath. Something I like to do sometimes when I do the breath meditation is after I'm, you know, aware of the breath, and then I ask myself, what is this breath? What is this air that I breathe? And in that moment, I realize all of us is we are breathing the same air. Your air going to my lung, my air going to your lungs, so it gets a bit stale after a while, that's when we have to open the window. And then we open the window and then we get the air from the tree, from the bird, from everything that is alive. And so, we totally connected. We totally interconnected. And through that, again, it's back to this love, this compassion, this appreciation for this interconnection of life. So we can see that actually this vipassana, this looking deeply, this experiential inquiry is not a dry intellectual analysis. But actually it's an experiential inquiry which I would say transform. The anchoring the concentration, I see it as in we creating space. And then I see the inquiry as transformative, as what's going to transform when we fix, when we solidify, and then to open up to wisdom, to open up to compassion, to love, to connection. So, my time is up.